so nothing could grow or take root. In all our villages, we saw the plumes of smoke rising. We saw them going up also on the other side of the wood, far away in Russia, and knew they were doing the same. But the fires always died when they reached the shadow beneath the dark trees. I climbed down from the sleigh. Boris looked down at me, his face tense and afraid. But he said, "I'll wait," although I knew he couldn't. Wait how long? For what? Wait here, in the wood's very shadow? I thought of my own father, waiting for Marta, if our places had been changed. I shook my head. If I could bring Kasia out, I thought I could get her to the tower. I hoped the dragon spell would let us in. "Go home," I said, and then I asked him, wanting suddenly to know, "Is Marta well?" He nodded slightly. "She's married," he said, and then he hesitated and said, "There is a child coming." I remembered her at the choosing, 5 months ago. Her red dress, her beautiful black braids, her narrow, pale, frightened face. It didn't seem possible we'd ever stood next to each other, just the same, her and me and Kasia in a row. It took my breath, hard and painful, to imagine her sitting at her own hearth, already a young matron, getting ready for childbed. "I am glad," I said with an effort, refusing to let my mouth close up with jealousy. It wasn't that I wanted a husband and a baby. I didn't. Or rather, I only wanted them the way I wanted to live to 100. Someday, far off, never thinking about the particulars. But they meant life. She was living, and I wasn't. Even if I came somehow out of the wood alive again, I'd never have what she had. And Kasia might already be dead. But I wouldn't go into the wood with ill wishing. I took a deep, hard breath and made myself say, "I wish her an easy birth and a healthy child." I even managed to mean it. Childbirth was frightening enough, even if it was a more familiar terror. "Thank you," I added, and turned away to cross over the barren ground to the wall of great dark trunks. I heard the jingle of the harness behind me as Boris turned the horses and trotted away, but the sound was muffled and soon faded. I didn't look around, taking step after step, until I stopped just beneath the first boughs. A little snow was falling, soft and quiet, whence as like it was cold in my hand as I opened it. Yaga had half a dozen different finding spells, small and easy. It seemed she'd had a habit of misplacing things. "Loyatalal," I said softly to the small coiled braid of Kasia's hair. "Good for finding the whole from a part," the scribbled note on the spell had said. My breath fogged into a small pale cloud and drifted away from me, leading the way into the trees. I stepped between two trunks and followed it inside the wood. I expected it to be more dreadful than it was, but at first it seemed only an old, old forest. The trees were great pillars in a dark, endless hall, well apart from one another, their twisting, gnarled roots blanketed in dark green moss, small ferns curled up close for the night. Tall, pale mushrooms grew in hosts, like toy soldiers marching. The snow hadn't reached the ground beneath the trees, not even now, in the deep of winter. A thin layer of frost clung to the leaves and fine branches. I heard an owl calling somewhere distantly as I picked my way carefully through the trees. The moon was still above, clear white light coming through the bare branches. I followed my own faint breath and imagined myself a small mouse hiding from owls. A small mouse hunting for a piece of corn, a hidden nut. When I went gleaning in the forest, I often daydreamed as I walked. I lost myself in the cool shady green, in the songs of birds and frogs, in the running gurgle of a stream over rocks. I tried to lose myself the same way now, tried to be only another part of the forest, nothing worthy of attention. But there was something watching. I felt it more and more with every step the deeper I went into the wood. A weight laid heavily across my shoulders like an iron yoke. I had come inside, half expecting corpses hanging from every bough, wolves leaping at me from the shadows. Soon I was wishing for wolves. There was something worse here. The thing I had glimpsed looking out of Yerzy's eyes was here. Something alive. And I was trapped inside an airless room with it, pressed into a small corner. There was a song in this forest too, but it was a savage song, whispering of madness and tearing and rage. I crept on, my shoulders hunched, trying to be small. Then I came stumbling to a small stream, barely a rivulet, frost thick on both banks and black water running between them, the moonlight coming through the break in the trees. And there was a walker on the other side, its strange narrow stick head bent to the water to drink, its mouth like a crack open in its face. It lifted its head and looked straight at me, dripping. Its eyes were nuts in wood, round dark pouched holes that some small animal might have lived in. There was a scrap of green woolen cloth dangling from one of its legs, caught on a jutting spar at the joint. We stared at each other across the narrow running thread of the river. "Fool Medesh," I said, my voice shaking, and a crack in the ground opened beneath the walker and swallowed up its back legs. It scrabbled at the bank with the rest of its long stick limbs, thrashing silently, throwing up sprays of water, but the earth had closed up around the middle of its body, and it couldn't pull itself out. But I folded in on myself and swallowed a cry of pain. It felt like someone had hit me with a stick across my shoulders. The wood had felt my working. I was sure of it. The wood was looking for me now. It was looking, and soon it would find me. I had to force myself to move. I sprang over the stream and ran after my faint cloudy spell, which still drifted on ahead of me. The walker tried to catch at me with its long, cracked wood fingers as I skirted around it, but I ran past. I came through a ring of larger trunks and found myself in an open space around a smaller tree, the ground here heavy with snow. There was a fallen tree stretching across the space, a giant, its trunk taller across than I was. Its fall had opened up this clearing, and in the middle of it, a new tree had sprung up to take its place. But not the same kind of tree. All the other trees I'd seen in the wood had been familiar kinds, despite their stained bark and the twisted unnatural angles of their branches, oaks and black birch and tall pines. But this was no kind of tree I had ever seen. It was already larger around than the circle my arms could make, even though the giant tree couldn't have fallen very long ago. It had smooth gray bark over a strangely knotted trunk, with long branches in even circles around it, starting high up the trunk, like a larch. Its branches weren't bare with winter, but carried a host of dried-up silvery leaves that rustled in the wind, a noise that seemed to come from somewhere else, as though there were people just out of sight, speaking softly together. The trail of my breath had dissolved into the air. Looking down at the deep snow, I could see the marks where the walker's legs had poked through and the lines their bellies had drawn, all going to the tree. I took a wary step through the snow towards it, and then another, and then I stopped. Kasha was bound to the tree. Her back was against the trunk, and her arms drawn backwards around it. I hadn't seen her at first, because the bark had already grown over her. Her face was turned up a little, and beneath the skin of the covering bark, I could see her mouth had been open, screaming while the bark closed over her. I made a choked cry, helplessly, and staggered forward and put out my hands to touch her. The bark was hard beneath my fingers already, the gray skin smooth and hard, as though she had been swallowed into the trunk hole, all of her made a part of a tree, of the wood. I couldn't get a hold on the bark, though I tried frantically to claw and peel it away, but I managed at last to scrape off a little thin piece over her cheek, and beneath, I found her own soft skin, still warm, still alive. But even as I touched it with my fingertip, the bark crept quickly over it, and I had to draw back my hand, not to be caught myself. I covered my mouth with my hands, even more desperate. I still knew so little. No spell came to my mind, nothing that could get Kasia out, nothing that would even put an axe in my hands, a knife, even if there had been time to carve her free. The wood knew I was here. Even now, its creatures were moving towards me. Stealthy padding feet through the forest. Walkers and wolves and worse things still. I suddenly was sure that they were things that never left the wood at all. Things so dreadful, no one had ever seen them. And they were coming. With bare feet in the dirt, Fulmia, 10 times with conviction, will shake the earth to its roots, if you have the strength, Yaga's book had told me. And the dragon had believed it enough not to let me try it anywhere near the tower. I had felt doubtful, anyway, about conviction. I hadn't believed I had any business shaking the earth to its roots. But now, I fell to the ground and dug away the snow and the fallen leaves and rot and moss until I came to the hard frozen dirt. I pried up a large stone and began to smash at the earth, again and again, breaking up the dirt and breathing on it to make it softer, pounding in the snow that melted around my hands, pounding in the hot tears that dripped from my eyes as I worked. Kasia was above me, with her head flung up, her mouth open in its soundless cry, like a statue in a church. Fulmia, I said, my fingers deep in the dirt, crushing the solid clods between my fingers. Fulmia, Fulmia, I chanted over and over, bleeding from broken nails, and I felt the earth hear me, uneasily. Even the earth was tainted here, poisoned. But I spat on the dirt and screamed, Fulmia! And imagined my magic running into the ground like water, finding cracks and weaknesses, spreading out beneath my hands, beneath my cold, wet knees, and the earth shuddered and turned over. A low trembling began where my hands drove into the ground, and it followed me as I started prying at the roots of the tree. The frozen dirt began to break up into small chunks all around them, the tremors going on and on like waves. The branches above me were waving wildly, as if in alarm, the whispering of the leaves becoming a muted roaring. I straightened up on my knees. Let her out! I screamed at the tree. I beat on its trunk with my muddy fists. Let her out, or I'll bring you down! Fulmia! I cried out in rage and threw myself back down at the ground, and where my fists hit, the ground rose and swelled like a river rising with the rain. Magic was pouring out of me, a torrent, every warning the dragon had ever given me, forgotten and ignored. I would have spent every drop of myself and died there, just to bring that horrible tree down. I couldn't imagine a world where I lived, where I left this behind me, Kasia's life and heart, feeding this corrupt, monstrous thing. I would rather have died, crushed in my own earthquake, and brought it down with me. I tore at the ground, ready to break open a pit to swallow us all. And then, with a sound like ice breaking in the spring, the bark cracked open, running up and down the length of Kasia's body. I lunged up from the dirt at once and dug my fingers into the crack, prying the sides wide and reaching in for her. I caught her wrist, her arm limp and heavy, and pulled. She fell out of the horrible bark gap, bending at the waist like a rag doll, and I backed away, dragging her dead weight free into the snow, both my hands wrapped around her wrist. Her skin was fish pale, sickly, like all the sun had been drunk out of her. Sap smelling like spring rain ran over her and thin green rivulets, and she didn't move. I fell to my knees beside her. "Kasha," I said, sobbing, "Kasha." The bark had already closed itself up like a seam around the hole where she had been. I caught Kasha's hands in my wet, dirty ones and pressed them to my cheeks, to my lips. They were cold, but not as cold as my own. There was a trace of life in them. I bent down and heaved her onto my shoulders. Chapter 8. I came staggering out of the wood at dawn, with Kasha slung across my shoulders like a bundle of firewood. The wood had drawn back from me as I went, as if it feared driving me back to the spell. Fulmia rang in my head like a deep bell, sounding with every heavy step I took. Kasha's weight on top of mine, dirt still covering my hands on her pale arm and leg. Finally, I floundered out of the trees into the deep snow at the border and fell. I crawled out from under Kasha and pushed her over. Her eyes were still closed. Her hair was matted and sticky around her face, where sap had soaked it. I heaved her head up against my shoulder and closed my eyes and spoke the spell. The dragon was waiting for us in the high tower room. His face was hard and grim as ever I had seen it, and he gripped me by the chin and jerked my head up. I looked back at him, exhausted and empty, while he studied my face and searched my eyes. He was holding a bottle of some cordial in his hands. After he'd looked at me a long while, he jerked out the stopper and thrust it at me. "Drink it," he said. "The whole thing." He went over to where Kasha sprawled on the floor, still unmoving. He held his hands out over her and glared down at me when I made a note of protest and reached out. "Now," he snapped. "Unless you want to force me to incinerate her at once, so I can deal with you." He waited until I began drinking, then murmured a quick spell, sprinkling some crushed dust over her body. A shining amber gold net sprang out over her, like a birdcage, and he turned to watch me drink. The first taste was inexpressibly good, like a swallow of warm honey with lemon down a sore throat. But as I kept drinking, my stomach began to turn from too much sweetness. I had to hold halfway through. "I can't," I said, choking. "All of it," he said, "and then a second one, if I think it necessary. Drink." And I forced down another swallow, and another, until I drained the glass. Then he seized me by the wrists and said, "Ulogistus sovienta, mejiot kojol. Ulogistus mejiot." And I screamed. It felt like he'd set fire to me from the inside. I could see light shining through my own skin, making a blazing lantern of my body, and when I held up my hands, I saw, to my horror, faint shadows moving there beneath the surface. Forgetting the feverish pain, I caught at my dress and dragged it off over my head. He knelt down on the floor with me. I was shining like a sun, the thin shadows moving through me, like fish swimming beneath the ice in winter. "Get them out," I said. Now that I saw them, I suddenly felt them also, leaving a trail inside me, like slime. I'd thought, stupidly, that I was safe because I hadn't been caught or bitten. I'd thought he was only taking precautions. Now I understood. I'd breathed in corruption with the very air, under the boughs of the wood, and I hadn't noticed the creeping feeling of them because they'd slipped in, small and subtle. "Get them out!" "Yes, I'm trying," he bit out, gripping me by the wrists. He shut his eyes and began to speak again, a long, slow chanting that went on and on, feeding the fire. I fixed my eyes on the window, on the sunlight coming in. I tried to breathe while I burned. Tears ran down my face in rivulets, scorching hot against my cheeks. His grip on my arms felt cool by comparison, for once. The shadows beneath my skin were growing smaller, their edges burning away in the light, sand wearing away in water. They darted around, trying to find places to hide, but he didn't let the light fade anywhere. I could see my bones and my organs as glowing shapes inside me, one of them, my very heart, thumping in my breast. It was slowing, each beat heavier. I understood dimly that the question was whether he could burn the corruption out of me quicker than my body could bear. I swayed in his hands. He shook me abruptly, and I opened my eyes to find him glaring at me. He didn't break the course of his spell even for a moment, but he didn't need to say a word. "Don't you dare waste my time, you outrageous idiot," his furious eyes said, and I set my teeth in my lip and held on a little longer. The last few shadow fish were being worn away to wriggling threads, and then they vanished, grown so thin they couldn't be seen. He slowed the chant and paused it. The fire banked a little, an inexpressible relief. He demanded grimly, "Enough?" I opened my mouth to say yes, to say please. "No," I whispered, horribly afraid now. I could feel the faint, quicksilver trace of the shadows still inside me. If we stopped now, they would curl up deep, hiding in my veins and my belly. They would take root and grow and grow and grow until they strangled all the rest of me. He nodded once. He held out his hand, murmured a word, and another flask appeared. I shuddered. He had to help me tip a swallow into my open mouth. I choked it down, and he took up the chant again. The fire rose in me again, endless, blinding, burning. After three more swallows, each one stoking the fire back up to full height, I was almost sure. I forced myself to one more after that, to be certain, and then finally, almost sobbing, I said, "Enough. It's enough." But then he took me by surprise and forced another swallow on me. As I spluttered, he put his hand over my mouth and nose and used a different chant, one that didn't burn but closed my lungs. For five horrible heartbeats, I couldn't breathe at all. Clawing at him and drowning in the open air, it was worse than everything else had been. I was staring at him, seeing his dark eyes fixed on me, implacable and searching. They began to swallow up all the world. My sight was closing, my hands were going weak. Then at last he stopped, and my frantic lungs swelled open like a bellows, dragging in a rush of air. I yelled with it, a furious wordless shout, and shoved him away from me, so he went sprawling back across the floor. He twisted up, managing to keep the flask from spilling, and we glared at each other, equally angry. "Of all the extraordinary stupidities I have ever seen you perform," he snarled at me. "You could have told me," I shouted, arms wrapped around my body, still shaking with the horror of it. "I stood all the rest. I could have stood that, too." "Not if you were corrupted," he said flatly, breaking in. "If you were taken deep, you would have tried to evade it, if I'd told you." "Then you would have known anyway," I said, and he pressed his mouth hard into a thin line and looked away from me with an odd stiffness. "Yes," he said shortly, "I would have known. And then would have had to kill me. He would have had to slay me while I pleaded, maybe, while I begged him and pretended to be, perhaps even thought myself, as I had, untainted." I fell silent, catching my breath in slow, measured, deep draughts. "And am I? Am I clean?" I asked finally, dreading the answer. "Yes," he said. "No corruption could have hidden from that last spell. If we'd done it sooner, it would have killed you. The shadows would have had to steal the breath from your blood to live. I sagged limply in on myself and covered my face. He pulled himself to his feet and stoppered the flask. He murmured, Vanastalem, moving his hands, and stepped over to me. He thrust out a neatly folded cloak, heavy silk-lined velvet, deep green, embroidered in gold. I looked at it blankly and stared up at him, and only when he looked away from me with an annoyed, stiff expression did I realize that the last glowing embers were dying beneath my skin and I was still naked. Then I staggered up to my feet abruptly, holding the cloak clutched against me, forgotten. Kasha, I said urgently, and turned towards her, where she lay beneath the cage. He didn't say anything. I looked back at him desperately. Go and dress, he said finally. There is no urgency. He'd seized me the instant I came into the tower. He hadn't let a moment pass. There must be a way, I said. There has to be a way. They'd only just taken her. She couldn't have been in the tree for long. What? He said sharply, and listened with his brows drawing as I spilled out the horror of the clearing of the tree. I tried to tell him about the dreadful weight of the wood watching me, the feeling of being hunted. I stumbled over it all. Words didn't seem enough. But his face grew more dark, until at last I finished, with that last staggering rush out into the clean snow. You've been inexpressibly lucky, he said finally, and inexpressibly mad, although in your case the two seem to be the same thing. No one has gone into the wood as deep as you and come out whole. Not since... He halted, and I somehow knew without his saying her name that it was Yaga, that Yaga had walked in the wood and come out again. He saw my realization and glared at me. And at the time, he said icily, she was 100 years old, and so steeped in magic that black toadstools would spring up where she walked. And even she wasn't stupid enough to start a great working in the middle of the place, although I will grant that in this case, it's the only thing that saved you. He shook his head. I should have chained you to the wall as soon as that peasant woman came here to weep on your shoulder, I suppose. Wensa, I said, my dull, exhausted mind latching on to one thing. I have to go tell Wensa. I looked towards the hallway, but he cut in. Tell her what? He said. That Kasha's alive, I said. That she's out of the wood. And that she will surely have to die? He said brutally. Instinctively, I backed towards Kasha, putting myself between them, holding my hands up, futile if he had meant to overcome me, but he shook his head. Stop mantling at me like a rooster, he said, more wary than irritated. The tone made my chest clench in dismay. The last thing we need is any further demonstrations that you'll go to fool's length for her sake. You can keep her alive as long as we can keep her restrained. But you'll find it a mercy by the end. I did tell Wensa when she woke a little later that morning. She clutched my hands, wild-eyed. Let me see her, she demanded. But that much the dragon had flatly forbidden. No, he said. You can torment yourself if you want to. That's as far as I'll go. Make that woman no false promises, and don't let her come anywhere near. If you'll take my advice, you'll tell her the girl is dead, and let her get on with her life. But I steeled myself and told her the truth. Better, I thought, to know that Kasha was out of the wood, that there was an end to her torment, even if there wasn't a cure. I wasn't sure if I was right. Wensa wailed and wept and begged me. If I could have, I would have disobeyed and taken her. But the dragon didn't trust me with Kasha. He had already taken her away and put her in a cell somewhere, deep beneath the tower. He'd told me he wouldn't show me the way down until I'd learned a spell of protection, something to guard myself from the wood's corruption. I had to tell Wensa that I couldn't, I had to swear it to her on my heart over and over before she would believe me. I don't know where he's put her, I cried out finally. I don't. She stopped begging and stared at me, panting, her hands gripping my arms. Then she said, Wicked, jealous. You always hated her, always. You wanted her to be taken. You and Galinda. You knew he'd take her. You knew, and you were glad. And now you hate her, because he took you instead. She was shaking me in jerks, and for a moment, I couldn't stop her. It was too horrible, hearing her say these things to me, like poison spilling out where I'd looked for clean water. I was so desperately tired, ill from the purging, and all my strength spent in bringing Kasia out. I wrenched myself loose at last and ran from the room, unable to bear it, and stood in a hallway leaning against the wall, crying messily, too spent even to wipe my face. Wensa crept out after me in a moment, weeping herself. Forgive me, she said. Neshka, forgive me. I didn't mean it. I didn't. I knew she hadn't meant it. But it was also true. A little. In twisted ways. It dredged up my own secret guilt. My cry. Why didn't you take Kasia instead? We had been glad all those years, my mother and I, to think I wouldn't be taken. And I had been miserable afterwards, even if I'd never hated Kasia for it. I wasn't sorry when the dragon sent Wensa home. I didn't even argue very much when he refused to try and teach me the spell of protection that very day. Try not to be more of a fool than you can help, he snapped. You need rest. And if you don't, I certainly do, before facing the undoubtedly torturous process of drumming the necessary protections into your head. There is no need for haste. Nothing is going to change. But if Kasia's infested as I was, I started and stopped. He was shaking his head. A few shadows slipped between your teeth, purging you at once, kept them from getting a hold on you, he said. This isn't anything like that, nor even some third-hand infestation, like that luckless cowherder you turned to stone for no good reason. Do you understand that the tree you saw is one of the heart trees of the wood? Where they take root, its borders spread. The walkers are fed on their fruit. She was as deep in the wood's power as any person can be. Go to sleep. A few hours won't make a difference to her, and it may keep you from committing some new folly. I was too tired, and I knew it, reluctantly, though I felt argument coiling in my belly. I put it away for later. But if I'd listened to him and his caution in the first place, Kasia would still be there inside the heart tree, being devoured and rotted away. If I'd swallowed everything he told me of magic, I'd still have been chanting cantrips to my exhaustion. He had told me himself no one had ever been brought out of the heart tree. No one had ever come out of the wood. But Yaga had done it. And now I had, too. He could be mistaken. He was mistaken about Kasia. He was. I was up before first light. In Yaga's book, I found a spell for smelling out rot. A simple chant. Aish, aish, aishimad. And I worked it down in the kitchens, picking out a place where mold grew on the back of a barrel, a spot of rotting mortar in the walls, bruised apples and one spoiled cabbage that had rolled away under a shelf of wine bottles. When sunlight finally brightened the stairway, I went up to the library and started banging books off the shelves loudly until he appeared, tired-eyed and irritable. He didn't chide me. He only looked a brief frown and then turned away without saying a word. I would have preferred it if he'd shouted. But he took a small gold key and unlocked a closed cabinet of black wood on the far side of the room. I peered into it. It was full of thin, flat sheets of glass in the rack, pieces of parchment pressed between them. He took one and brought it out. "I've preserved it mostly as a curiosity," he said, "but that seems to suit you best." He laid it on the table, still in its glass, a single page in sprawling messy script, many of the letters oddly shaped, with rough illustrations of a branch of pine needles, the smoke going into the nostrils of a face. There were a dozen different variations listed. Sol tal videl, sol yata accorata, videlaren, accordel, estepum. More besides. "Which one do I use?" I asked him. "What?" he said, and prickled up indignantly when I told him they were separate incantations, not one long chant, in the way that meant he hadn't realized it before. "I haven't the least idea," he said shortly. "Choose one and try." I couldn't help but be secretly, passionately glad. Another proof that his knowledge had limits. I went to the laboratory for pine needles and made a small smudgy bonfire of them in a glass bowl on the library table. Then bent my head eagerly over the parchment and tried. "Sol tal," I said, feeling the shape of it in my mouth. But there was something wrong, a kind of sideways sliding to it. "Valoditash aloito, kesh valofoj," he said, a hard, bitter sound that curled into me like fish hooks. And then he made a quick jerk of one finger, and my hands rose up from the table and clapped themselves together three times. It wasn't like having no control, the involuntary lurch of coming out of a dream, of falling. I could feel the deliberation behind the movement, the puppet strings digging into my skin. Someone had moved my arms, and it hadn't been me. I nearly reached for some spell to strike at him, and then he crooked his finger again, and the fish hook came loose, and the line slithered back out of me. I was up on my feet, halfway across the room from him, panting before I could stop myself. I glared, but he didn't offer me an apology. "When the wood does it," he said, "you won't feel the hook. Try again." It took me an hour to work out an incantation. None of the ones came out right, not the way they were on paper. I had to try them all on my tongue, rolling them this way and that, before I finally realized that some of the letters weren't meant to sound the same way I thought they did. I tried changing them until I stumbled over a syllable that felt right in my mouth, then another, and another, until I had put it together. He made me practice it over and over for hours more. I breathed in pine smoke and breathed out the words, and then he prodded at my mind with one unpleasant twisting of a spell and another. He finally let me stop for a rest at noon. I crumbled into a chair, hedgehog prickled and exhausted. The barriers had held, but I felt very much as though I'd been jabbed repeatedly with sharp sticks. I looked down at the old vellum, so carefully sealed away with the strange-shaped letters. I wondered how old it was. "Very old," he said. "Older than Polnia, it might even be older than the wood." I stared at him. It hadn't occurred to me even to think before then that the wood hadn't always been here, always been what it was. He shrugged. "For all we know, it has. It's certainly older than Polnia and Rosia. It was here before this valley was ever settled by either of us." He tapped the parchment in the glass. "These were the first people who lived in this part of the world, so far as we know, some 1,000 years ago. Their sorcerer kings brought the tongue of magic west with them, from the barren lands on the far side of Rosia, when they first settled this valley. And then the wood rolled over them, brought their fortresses low, and laid their fields waste. There is little left of their work now." "But," I said, "if the wood wasn't here when they first settled the valley, where did it come from?" The dragon shrugged. If you go to the capital, you'll find any number of troubadours who will be happy to sing you The Rising of the Wood. It's a popular subject among them, at least when they have an audience that knows less about it than they do. It offers them enormous scope for creativity. I suppose there is a chance one of them has hit on the true story. Light the fire, and let's begin again. It wasn't until late that evening, as the light was failing, that he was satisfied with my work. He tried to send me to bed, but I wouldn't have it. Wenza's words still grated and scraped in the back of my head, and it occurred to me that perhaps he'd wanted me exhausted so he could put me off for another day. I wanted to see Kasha with my own eyes. I wanted to know what I was facing. This corruption, I had to find a way to fight. "No," I said. "No. You said I could see her when I could protect myself." He threw up his hands. "All right," he said. "Follow me." He led me to the bottom of the stairs and into the cellars past the kitchen. I remembered searching all those walls in desperation when I thought he was draining my life. I had run my hands over every wall, poked my fingers into every crack, and tugged on every worn brick, trying to find a way out. But he led me to a smooth, polished part of the wall, a single entire slab of pale white stone, unbroken by any mortar. He touched it lightly with the fingers of one hand and crooked them up like a spider. I felt the faint thrill of his magic working. The whole slab swung back into the wall, revealing a stairwell of the same pale stone, shining dimly, that bent steeply downwards. I followed him down the passage. It was different from the rest of the tower, older and more strange. The steps were hard-edged on either side, but worn in the middle to softness, and letters had been carved in a line running along the base of both walls, a script neither ours or Rossian, very much like the shape of the letters on the parchment with the protection spell. We seemed to go down for a long time, and I was increasingly aware of the weight of stone around us, of silence. It felt like a tomb. "It is a tomb," he said. We had reached the bottom of the stairs, coming into a small round room. The very air seemed thicker. The writing came off one wall of the stairwell, continued all around it in an unbroken line that circled to the opposite side, went up the wall in a tall curve that drew an arch, and then came back and went up the other side of stairs. There was a small patch of lighter stone inside the arch, towards the bottom, as though the rest of the wall had been built and then had been closed up afterwards. It looked, perhaps, the size for a man to crawl through. Is someone still buried here?" I asked timidly. My voice came out hushed. "Yes," the dragon said. "But even kings don't object to sharing once they're dead." "Listen to me now," he said, turning to me. "I am not going to teach you the spell to walk through the wall. When you want to see her, I'll take you through myself. If you try to touch her, if you let her come in arm's reach of you, I'll take you out again at once. Now, lay on your protections, if you insist on doing this." I lit the small handful of pine needles on the floor and made the chant, putting my face in their smoke, and then I put my hand in his and let him draw me through the wall. He'd made me fear the worst. Kasha, as tormented as Yorzi, foaming-mouthed and tearing at her own skin. Kasha, full of those slithering, corrupted shadows, eating away at everything inside her. I was prepared for anything. I braced myself. But when he brought me through the wall, she was only sitting huddled and small, in the corner on a thin pallet, her arms around her knees. There was a plate of food and water on the floor next to her, and she'd eaten and drunk, she'd washed her face, her hair was neatly plaited. She looked tired and afraid, but still herself, and she struggled up to her feet and came to me, holding out her hands. "Nyeshka," she said. "Nyeshka, you found me." "No closer," the dragon said flatly, and added, Valur Poljus. And a sudden line of hot flame leaped up across the floor between us. I'd been reaching towards her without being able to help it. I dropped my hands to my sides and clenched them into fists, and Kasha stepped back, too, staying behind the fire. She nodded obediently to the dragon. I stood staring at her, helplessly, full of involuntary hope. Are you? I said, and my voice choked in my throat. I don't know, Kasha said, her voice trembling. I don't remember. Not anything after they took me into the wood. They took me into the wood, and they... She stopped, her mouth open a little. There was horror in her eyes, the same horror Ad felt when Ad found her in the tree, buried beneath the skin. I had to stop myself reaching out to her. I was in the wood again myself, seeing her blind, choked face, her pleading hands. Don't speak of it, I said, thick and miserable. I felt a surge of anger at the dragon for holding me back this long. I had already made plans in my head. I would use Yaga's spell to find where that corruption had taken root in her. Then I would ask the dragon to show me the purging spells he'd used on me. I would look through Yaga's book and find others like it and drive it out of her. Don't think of it yet. Just tell me, how do you feel? Are you sick or cold? I finally looked around at the room itself. The walls were of that same polished, bone-white marble, and in a deep niche at the back, a heavy stone box lay, longer than the height of a man, carved along the top in the same letters and other designs on the sides, tall flowering trees and vines curling over each other. A single blue flame burned on top of it, and air flowed in from a thin slit in the wall. It was a beautiful room, but utterly cold. It wasn't a place for any living thing. We can't keep her here, I said to the dragon fiercely, even as he shook his head. She needs sun and fresh air. We can lock her into my room instead. Better here than the wood, Kasha said. Neshka, please tell me, is my mother all right? She tried to follow the walkers. I was afraid they'd take her too. Yes, I said, wiping my face, taking a deep breath. She's all right. She's worried for you. She's so worried. I'll tell her you're all right. Can I write her a letter? Kasha asked. No, the dragon said. An eye wheeled on him. We can't give her a stub of pencil and some paper, I said angrily. It's not too much to ask. His face was bleak. You aren't this much a fool, he said to me. Do you think she was buried in a heart tree for a night and a day and came out talking to you ordinarily? I stopped, silent, afraid. Yaga's wrath-finding spell hovered on my lips. I opened my mouth to cast it, but it was Kasha. It was my own Kasha, who I knew better than anyone in the world. I looked at her, and she looked back at me, unhappy and afraid, but refusing to weep or cower. It was her. They put her in the tree, I said. They saved her for it, and I brought her out, before it got a hold. No, he said flatly, and I glared at him and turned back to her. She smiled at me anyway, a struggling, valiant smile. It's all right, Neshka, she said. As long as Mama's all right. What? She swallowed. What's to happen to me? I didn't know how to answer her. I'll find the way to cleanse you, I said, half desperate and didn't look at the dragon. I'll find a spell to be sure you are all right. But those were just words. I didn't know how I could ever prove to the dragon that Kasha was well. He plainly didn't want to be convinced. And if I couldn't persuade him somehow, he would keep Kasha down here the rest of her life, if need be, entombed with this ancient king and without a scrap of sunlight, never to see anyone she loved, never to live at all. He was as great a danger to Kasia as the wood. He hadn't wanted me to rescue her at all. And even before then, it occurred to me in a flash of bitterness. He had meant to steal her for himself. He'd meant to take her as much as the wood had, to devour her in his own way. He hadn't cared about uprooting her life before, making her a prisoner in the tower only to serve him. Why would he care now? Why would he ever risk letting her out? He stood a few steps behind me, farther from the fire and from Kasia. His face was closed, yielding nothing. His thin mouth pressed hard. I looked away and tried to smooth out my face and hide my thoughts. If I could find a spell to let me pass through the wall, I would only have to find a way to evade his notice. I could try and put a spell of sleep on him, or could put something in his cup with his dinner. Wormwood brewed with yew berries, cook the juice down to a paste, put in 3 drops of blood, and speak an incantation, and it will make a quick poison with no taste. The sudden sharp pungent smell of burning pine needles came back into my nose, and the thought took on a strange bitter edge that made the wrongness of it leap out. I flinched away from it, startled, and I took a step back from the line of fire, trembling. On the other side, Kasia was waiting for me to speak, her face resolute, clear-eyed, full of trust and love and gratitude, and a little fear and worry, but nothing but ordinary human feeling. I looked at her, and she looked back at me anxiously, still herself. But I couldn't speak. The smell of pine was still in my mouth, and my eyes stung with smoke. Nieshka, Kasia said, her voice wavering with growing fear. I still said nothing. She was staring at me across the line of fire, and her face through the haze seemed to be first smiling and then unhappy, her mouth trembling through one shape and another, trying different expressions. I took another step back, and it grew worse. Her head tilted, eyes fixed on my face, widening a little. She shifted her weight, a different stance. Nieshka, she said, not sounding afraid anymore, only confident and warm. It's all right. I know you'll help me. The dragon beside me was silent. I dragged in a breath. I still said nothing. My throat was shut. I managed on a whisper. Ey, Shimad. A pungent, bitter smell rose in the air between us. Please, Kasia said to me. Her voice suddenly broke on a sob, an actor in a play moving from one act to the next. She lifted her hands towards me, came a little closer to the fire, her body leaning in. She came a little too close. The smell grew stronger, like green wood burning, full of sap. Nieshka! Stop it! I cried. Stop it! She stopped. For a moment still, Kasia stood there, and then it let her arms drop to her sides, and her face emptied out. A wave of rotting wood smell rolled over the room. The dragon raised a hand. Kulkias, Vishkias, Hai Shimad, he said, and a light shone out of his hand and onto her skin. Where it played over her, I saw thick green shadows, mottled like deep layers of leaves on leaves. Something looked at me out of her eyes, its face still and strange and inhuman. I recognized it. What looked out at me was the same thing I had felt in the wood, trying to find me. There was no trace of Kasia left at all. Chapter 9. He was half supporting me as he pulled me through the wall and out into the antechamber of the tomb again. When we were through, I slid to the floor next to my small heap of pine needle ashes and stared at them, hollow. I almost hated them for stealing the life from me. I couldn't even cry. It was worse than if Kasia were dead. He stood over me. There is a way, I said, looking up at him. There is a way to get it out of her. It was a child's cry, a plea. He said nothing. That spell you used on me. No, he said, not for this. The purging spell barely worked even on you. I warned you. Did it try to persuade you to harm yourself? I shivered all over horribly, remembering the ashen taste of that horrible thought creeping through my head. Wormwood and yew berries, a quick poison. You, I said. He nodded. It would have liked that. Persuade you to kill me, then find some way to lure you back to the wood. What is it? I said. What is that thing inside her? We say the wood. But those trees... I was abruptly sure of it. Those trees are corrupted, too, as much as Kasha. That's where it lives, not what it is. We don't know, he said. It was here before we came. Perhaps before they were, he added, gesturing to the walls with their strange foreign inscription. They walked the wood, or made it, and they fought it a while, and then it destroyed them. This tomb is all that's left. There was an older tower here. Little of it remained, except bricks scattered on the earth by the time Polnia claimed this valley and roused the wood again. He fell silent. I remained sunk in on myself, curled up around my knees on the floor. I couldn't stop shivering. Finally, he said heavily, "Are you ready to let me end this? Most likely, there is nothing left of her to rescue." I wanted to say yes. I wanted that thing gone, destroyed. The thing that wore Kasha's face, that used not only her hands, but everything in her heart, in her mind, to destroy those she loved. I almost didn't care if Kasha was in there. If she was, I couldn't imagine anything more horrible than to be trapped in her own body, that thing dangling her like a monstrous puppet. And I couldn't persuade myself to doubt the dragon anymore when he said that she was gone, beyond the reach of any magic he knew. But I had saved him when he had thought himself beyond rescue too. And I still knew so little, stumbling from one impossibility to another. I imagined the agony of finding a spell in a book, a month from now, a year, that might have worked. Not yet, I whispered. Not yet. If I had been an indifferent student before, now I was dreadful in a wholly different way. I turned ahead in books, and took ones he didn't give me down from the shelves if he didn't catch me. I looked into anything and everything I could find. I would work spells out halfway, discard them, and go onward. I would throw myself into workings without being sure I had the strength. I was running wild through the forest of magic, pushing brambles out of my way, heedless of scratches and dirt, paying no attention where I was going. At least every few days, I would find something with enough faint promise that I would convince myself it was worth trying. The dragon took me down to Kasha to try whenever I asked, which was far more often than I managed to find anything really worth trying. He let me tear apart his library and said nothing when I spilled oils and powders across his table. He didn't press me to let Kasha go. I hated him and his silence ferociously. I knew he was only letting me convince myself there was nothing to be done. She, the thing inside her, didn't try to pretend anymore. She watched me with bird-bright eyes and smiled occasionally when my workings did nothing. A horrible smile. "Agnieszka, Agnieszka," she sang softly, over and over. Sometimes, if I was trying an incantation, so I had to stumble on through it while listening to her, I would come out feeling bruised and sick to my bones, and climb the stairs again slowly, with tears dripping from my face. Spring was rolling over the valley by then. If I looked from my window, which I did now only rarely, every day I could watch the spindle running riotous white with melted ice.